This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last week was a major setback for the Middle East peace process. Today, a summit meeting began in Washington involving Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Scores of people died last week during protests after Israel opened a new entrance to an archaeological tunnel. The entrance was in the old city of Jerusalem, near one of the holiest Muslim shrines. My guest Amos Oz is one of Israel's best-known peace activists and most popular novelists. His latest novel, Don't Call It Night, has just been published in the States. We called him yesterday to talk about his two obsessions, peace and literature. His new novel is about the marriage between a 60-year-old civil engineer and a 45-year-old teacher. They live in a small desert community in Israel where people dream about and long for faraway places. Oz lives in a desert community, and he says the desert is good for his writing.
Well, it helps me knock things into proportion. You know, I start my day every day by taking a half an hour's walk into the wilderness. And the wilderness reminds me that each time the politicians here in the Middle East speak about the rest of eternity or forever or never, never, the Middle Eastern never usually means something between 6 months and 30 years. The stones are laughing when politicians are speaking about eternity. So the desert is a great humbler.
Would you describe what the desert is like near your home? When you say you walk into the wilderness, describe what that walk is like.
The desert begins virtually 3 minutes' walk from my home. I cross the street, I pass the one block, and I am in the hilly, rocky, chalk and flint desert, where I can see the black goats and sometimes Bedouin shepherds, but usually nothing at all, just vast, empty spaces, totally unchanged since biblical times.
Are there any Palestinians living in your desert community, or are you near any Palestinian communities?
No, there is an Israeli Bedouin population in the area, but not a Palestinian population in this part of the Negev Desert. It had been empty for the last 1,000 years.
Do you think the fact that your community doesn't have Palestinians living in it and isn't near Palestinian communities affects the political views within the community?
Not necessarily. Israel is, the whole of Israel is about the size of the state of New Jersey. The occupied territories, or as I prefer to call them, Palestine, begin about 15 miles from here. So everything is very near, and the awareness is in every heart and on every mind, day and night. The problem is alive, and it's a part of everyone's life. The fact that in this novel, in Don't Call It Night, I put this problem in the background and not in the front has to do with the fact that I believe if life gets 100% political, then it is no life at all. And even in conflict-stricken eras and in tragic arenas, people still love and laugh and desire and envy and work and sometimes make mistakes.
How do you divide your time between writing about Israeli politics and telling stories in your fiction?
Well, when I get very angry, I write not a story and not a novel, but an article, telling my government what to do, sometimes telling my government where to go altogether, not that they listen. But when my mind is a little bit divided over anything at all, when I hear more than just one voice in me, that's when I know I'm pregnant with a novel. So I only write essays and articles for rage, not for storytelling. In fact, I have two different pens on my desk, very simple pens, you know, disposable pens, a sort of 99-cent pens, but two different pens, and I use one for my novels and stories and the other ones for what I call telling the government what to do.
How angry are you right now?
Quite angry.
Would you share your thoughts? Yeah, go ahead.
In the last few days, we have seen immense consequences of stupidity on both sides. I think the way the Netanyahu government deals with the Oslo Accords, the fact that they were trying to ignore or to postpone some of the Israeli commitments in the Oslo Accords contributed to the recent explosion. I think the tunnel in the old city in Jerusalem was a total stupidity, an act of autism. I think the tunnel is not necessarily an insult to Muslims, but they should have been consulted about it. They live in Jerusalem. They are part of the population of Jerusalem. They could have a say. They could have been discussed, and the thing could have been agreed upon. At the same time, I think the burst of orchestrated Palestinian violence against Israelis was a grim mistake, and worse than a mistake, because the Palestinians in the past have lost everything by trying to just kill Israelis rather than convince Israelis and persuade them.
What options do you think the Palestinians had to express their anger over the way the tunnel was handled?
Well, I mean, if they went out on a very angry demonstration or on a general strike, it would be perfectly legitimate. But to pick up the rifles supplied to them under the Oslo Accords and shooting at Israelis, this is no way to make peace.
This is the first time that Palestinian police and Israeli soldiers have actually fired at each other. Is that a potent image for Israelis and Palestinians?
Well, it certainly is a serious setback. It will be very difficult to put the peace process back on track, but it can be done and it has been to be done. You know, down the road, everybody knows that this is going to end with an historic compromise. The Israelis are here in this country. They are not going anywhere. The Palestinians are here in this country. They are not going anywhere. We cannot live together as one happy family. We must divide the country into two states. We must turn it into a two-family unit or a semi-detached home. This is the answer to the conflict. It's painful, it's frustrating, it's uneasy for both sides, but this is the only way, and it will have to be done, and I think deep down in their hearts or heart of hearts, most Israelis and most Palestinians know that in the end there will be some form of a partition. So why postpone it, and why the bloodshed, and why the maneuvers? Why can't the Israelis and the Palestinians sit down and start drawing a line on the map and calling this part of the country the home of the Israelis and that part of the country the home of the Palestinians?
Do you think Prime Minister Netanyahu is trying to back out of the peace plan or to force it to derail?
Well, his position is very strange. On the one hand, he claims openly that he is unhappy with the Oslo Accords between Israel and the Palestinians. On the other hand, he says that he is committed to those agreements. Now, you need to inject some enthusiasm into peacemaking. You can't make peace as if peace is a rape or an armed robbery. You have to present some generosity, some enthusiasm, some goodwill, some joy. And he doesn't show any of it. But then the Netanyahu government had been inflicted on Israel by the acts of terrorism last spring from some Muslim fundamentalists. Netanyahu is a result, the election of Netanyahu, the fact that he had been elected, is a direct result for a wave of unprovoked terrorism against Israeli citizens in February and March of this year. So rather than point a blaming finger at Israelis or at Palestinians, we need to sit down and get to work on a solution which deep down in our hearts we all know is unavoidable.
How important do you think the tunnel actually is? And maybe you could describe the tunnel for us.
The tunnel actually is an ancient water tunnel hewn in a rock underneath the surface of the old city in Jerusalem for a water supply thousands of years ago. In itself, it has no, I believe, no religious significance for anyone. It's a part of an ancient water supply system, but it's very close to the holy places, both the Muslim holy places and the Jewish holy places. It links the Wailing Wall, which is the holiest place for the Jews, with the Via Dolorosa, which is a very sacred place for the Christians. And it's very close to the Mount of Temple, which is very sacred for Muslims and for Jews. So it's the location of the tunnel rather than the tunnel itself that evokes sensibilities on all sides and sensitivities.
Have you been there? Have you either been to the tunnel or have you spent time on the Temple Mount, which is also known as Haram al-Sharif, the plateau that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is built on? This is a very holy place.
I have been there many times, not very recently, but I have been there many times, and I have seen that tunnel about 2 years ago, before it was opened to the public and before the recent opening of the far end of the tunnel. It was a one-way tunnel until a few days ago.
I wonder what it's like to be there and to if you can feel how old the area is and feel its kind of spiritual, symbolic value for Jews and Muslims.
Yes, I can see that it is immensely significant for many Jews. I can see how significant it is for many Muslims. It is not extremely significant for me personally because my Jewishness relies and relates to books and to texts and to spirituality rather than to holy stones. And my kind of Judaism has no particular leaning toward a sacred location. But I can see how important, how significant, how crucial it is in the minds of many believers.
My guest is Amos Oz, one of Israel's best-known peace activists and novelists. His new novel is called Don't Call It Night. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Israeli novelist and peace activist Amos Oz. Do you find yourself wondering what might have happened if Yitzhak Rabin had not been assassinated?
Very often. I think if Yitzhak Rabin would not have been assassinated, and if the Muslim fundamentalists would not have blown up those three buses in Israeli cities, the peace process would have made a considerable process of progress by now, and we would be sitting and dealing now with the terms of the comprehensive settlement. We could have been almost there now. Way ahead, at least way ahead of where we are at the moment.
Where were you when you found out about the assassination?
In New York City. I arrived in New York a day before the assassination, which is why I could not attend that particular rally where Rabin was assassinated. I was asked to be one of the speakers at this rally, but I left for New York a day earlier, and of course my world and my life changed. When I heard about the assassination, my first response was the dread and shock, because my daughter and my son-in-law and my grandchildren were there at the assembly. So you can imagine, I felt the bullets were actually fired at all of us, at the peace movement, at myself, at my family.
Did you know Rabin well?
I knew him quite well, yes.
So you missed him on a personal level, too?
I miss him both on a personal level and on a political level. He was a very brave man. He was a man who changed very late in life and changed radically. People do not normally change in the late 60s. He did. And he adopted positions about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which he himself opposed and condemned for many years. I admired this change of heart and change of mind in Rabin.
What do you think was the turning point in his change?
Well, I think during the Intifada, he gradually understood that there is no question of territories. It's a question of human beings. And we cannot simply, we Israelis cannot simply control the lives of more than 2 million Palestinians forever. They don't want to become Israelis. We do not want to force them to become Israelis. We need a third divorce, not a honeymoon, but a third divorce. This, I believe, Rabin and Peres, both of them, realized during the years of the Intifada.
What are your fears and hopes right now?
Well, my fears and my hopes focus around the same point. There is no alternative at the moment to the Oslo Accords, to the one and only Israeli-Palestinian agreement ever to have been signed in history. My deepest fear is that this agreement will collapse and then we will be back in square one, in a state of a total and fierce conflict between the two nations, the Israelis and the Palestinians, and possibly between Israel and much of the Arab world once again. This is my worst fear. My greatest hope is that the Oslo Accord can be put back on track and even speeded up. I think it can be done, and my ultimate hope is that the land which we call Israel and they call Palestine will be peacefully divided, and that the Israelis and the Palestinians will become decent neighbors, not necessarily one happy family, but decent neighbors in coexistence, in economical collaboration, in friendliness, not necessarily in love.
What kind of role do you think the United States can play in U.S. diplomacy?
Well, I think the United States in particular and the outside world in general should attend promptly to the sufferings of the Palestinian refugees in the refugee camps. The heart of the problem is not the holy places in Jerusalem. The heart of the problem is that hundreds of thousands of Palestinians are still living in degrading conditions in refugee camps which were created back in 1948. Those people ought to be provided with homes and jobs. We are not talking about the Soviet Union. We are not talking about India or Africa. We are talking a few hundred thousand people. It's not beyond the means of the international community, of the rich Arab nations, of the European community, of the United States, and indeed of Israel, to do something and promptly to give those people some hope for the future.
Meanwhile, within Israel, there's a movement among Orthodox Jews to apply Jewish law to government law, in other words, to close all shops on the Sabbath, which is Saturday. And what are some of the other things that are, that go along with that?
Well, that some of the Orthodox Jews would like for Israel to become a rabbinical state, dominated and controlled by rabbis in accordance to religious law, is a dream, because the vast majority of the Israeli Jews, about 80% of them, are secular. And it's not likely to happen. Of course, the Orthodox parties have been using the diversity between left and right and their own position, namely the position of the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox parties, as the balance between left and right, to influence legislation and to block some liberal and secular legislation. This is a long process. I don't think Israel can resolve this church and state issue, or in our case, synagogue and state issue, within a year or a decade. We don't want to fight a civil war of Jews against other Jews. We will have to compromise for a long time and leave the question uneasily opened for generations.
Could you live in a rabbinical state?
I don't think so. I don't think this is feasible. I don't think a rabbinical state could really exist. It contradicts itself. It has to do with the coming of the Messiah, and it has to do with very many messianic Jewish concepts. So it's highly unlikely that a rabbinical state could exist or survive.
Do you think there are... You go ahead.
I mean, the whole thing, the whole idea of a rabbinical state is highly hypothetical, simply because 8 out of 10 Israelis are secular and would reject such an idea.
Do you think there are any parallels between Muslim fundamentalism and the movement to make Israel a rabbinical state?
There are parallels between religious fanatics everywhere, in Christianity, in Islam, and in Judaism. Fanatics of all religions believe in instant redemption and in simple formula and in installing some divine law upon earth. All of those people tend to be uncompromising. How uncompromising, this varies from one group of extremists to another. Not every Orthodox Jew is an extremist. Not every Orthodox Jew is a fanatic. But we have our share. We are not immune to this universal disease of religious fanatism and fundamentalism. The United States is not immune. The Arab world is not immune, and Israel is not immune.
So tell me, are you writing today, and which pen will you write with?
Well, I have been working this morning with my essayistic pen on an article telling the government where I think it had gone very wrong. And yet, last night, I've been working with my other pen, adding maybe a sentence and a half to a piece of prose, a stubborn piece of prose. This is a very slow work. I am lamenting over punctuation. replacing a faulty adjective, rather like an old-fashioned watchmaker, you know, with a magnifying glass in my eye and a pair of scissors moving an adverb from one part of the sentence to another. This is the kind of work I do at night or early in the morning.
You know, you were telling us before about how you start every day with a half-hour walk in the desert. Do you do a lot of thinking about what you're writing while you're taking that walk?
Yes, in fact, I do my dialogues in my head. Sometimes I do them loud out there in the desert. No one can hear me. I need to hear the dialogues, so I speak out loud. And I imitate the voices. I try to assume different voices. It's a very funny practice. Can you think of a writer walking all by himself in the middle of the wilderness, talking in funny voices, arguing with himself?
Well, someone might think you were having visions.
Well, you know, in this business of prophecy, there is so much competition in this particular country that I would not even dream of going into this line of business.
Amos Oz, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Perry. Thank you very much.
Amos Oz spoke to us from his home in Israel. His latest novel has just been published in the U.S. It's called Don't Call It Night. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.